the Book of Judges. It's a tale of chaos unleashed, of violence unchained, and of a moral compass spinning wildly out of control. Ancient Israel's story? Perhaps. But as we peel back the pages, we'll find a mirror reflecting our own tumultuous times. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Sound familiar? Well, join us over the next few weeks as we study the Book of Judges, ancient wisdom for modern chaos. Our story begins now. Judges 20, verse 1. Then all Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, from the land of Gilead, came together as one and assembled before the Lord in Mizpah. The leaders of all the peoples of the tribes of Israel took their places in the assembly of God's people. 400,000 men armed with swords. The Benjaminites heard that the Israelites had gone out to Mizpah. Then the Israelites said, "Tell us how this awful thing happened." So the Levite, the husband of the murdered woman, said, "I and my concubine came to Gibeah in Benjamin to spend the night. During the night, the men of Gibeah came after me and surrounded the house, intending to kill me. They raped my concubine and she died. I took my concubine, cut her into pieces, and sent one piece to each region in Israel's inheritance, because they committed this lewd and outrageous act in Israel. Now, all you Israelites, speak up and tell me what you have decided to do." All the men rose up together as one, saying, "None of us will go home. No, not one of us will return to his house. But now this is what we'll do to Gibeah. We'll go up against it in the order decided by casting lots. We'll take 10 men out of every 100 from all the tribes of Israel, and 100 from 1,000, and 1,000 from 10,000, to get provisions for the army. Then, when the enemy arrives at Gibeah in Benjamin, it can give what they deserve for this outrageous act done in Israel." So all the Israelites got together and united as one against the city. The tribes of Israel sent messengers throughout the tribe of Benjamin, saying, "What about this awful crime that was committed among you? Now turn those wicked men of Gibeah over to us, so that we may put them to death and purge the evil from Israel." But the Benjaminites would not listen to their fellow Israelites. From their towns, they came together at Gibeah to fight against the Israelites. At once, the Benjaminites mobilized 26,000 swordsmen from their towns, in addition to 700 able young men from those living in Gibeah. Among all these soldiers, there were 700 select troops who were left-handed, each of whom could sling a stone at a hare and not miss. Israel, apart from Benjamin, mustered 400,000 swordsmen, all of them fit for battle. The Israelites went up to Bethel and inquired of God. They said, "Who of us is to go up first to fight against the Benjaminites?" The Lord replied, "Judah shall go up first." The next morning, the Israelites got up and pitched camp near Gibeah. The Israelites went out to fight the Benjaminites and took up battle positions against them at Gibeah. The Benjaminites came out of Gibeah and cut down 22,000 Israelites on the battlefield that day. But the Israelites encouraged one another and again took up their positions where they stationed themselves the first day. The Israelites went up and wept before the Lord until evening, and they inquired of the Lord. They said, "Shall we go up again to fight against the Benjaminites, our fellow Israelites?" The Lord answered, "Go up against them." Then the Israelites drew near to Benjamin the second day. This time, when the Benjaminites came out from Gibeah to oppose them, they cut down another 18,000 Israelites, all of them armed with swords. Then all the Israelites, the whole army, went up to Bethel, and there they sat weeping before the Lord. They fasted that day until evening and presented burnt offerings and fellowship offerings to the Lord. And the Israelites inquired of the Lord. In those days, the Ark of the Covenant of God was there, with Phinehas, son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, ministering before it. They asked, "Shall we go up again to fight against the Benjaminites, our fellow Israelites, or not?" The Lord responded, "Go, for tomorrow I will give them into your hands." Then Israel set an ambush around Gibeah. They went up against the Benjaminites on the third day and took up positions against Gibeah, as they had done before. The Benjaminites came out to meet them and were drawn away from the city. They began to inflict casualties on the Israelites as before. So about 30 men fell in the open field and on the roads, the one leading to Bethel and the other to Gibeah. While the Benjaminites were saying, We are defeating them. As before, the Israelites were saying, let's retreat and draw them away from the city to the roads. All the men of Israel moved from their places and took up positions at Baal Tamar. And the Israelite ambush charged out of its place on the west of Gibeah. Then 10,000 of Israel's able young men made a frontal attack on Gibeah. The fighting was so heavy that the Benjaminites did not realize how near disaster was. The Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel. And on that day, the Israelites struck down 25,100 Benjaminites, all armed with swords. Then the Benjaminites saw that they were beaten. Now the men of Israel had given way before Benjamin because they relied on the ambush they had set near Gibeah. Those who had been in ambush made a sudden dash into Gibeah, spread out and put the whole city to the sword. The Israelites had arranged with the ambush that they should send up a great cloud of smoke from the city, and then the Israelites would counterattack. The Benjaminites had begun to inflict casualties on the Israelites, about 30, and they said, we're defeating them as in the first battle. But when the column of smoke began to rise from the city, the Benjaminites turned and saw the whole city going up in smoke. Then the Israelites counterattacked, and the Benjaminites were terrified because they realized that disaster had come on them. So they fled before the Israelites in the direction of the wilderness, but they could not escape the battle. And the Israelites who came out of the towns cut them down there. They surrounded the Benjaminites, chased them, and easily overran them in the vicinity of Gibeah on the east. 18,000 Benjaminites fell, all of them valiant fighters. As they turned and fled towards the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon, the Israelites cut down 5,000 men along the roads. They kept pressing after the Benjaminites as far as Giddim and struck down 2,000 more. On that day, 25,000 Benjaminite swordsmen fell, all of them valiant fighters. But 600 of them turned and fled into the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon, where they stayed for 4 months. The men of Israel went back to Benjamin and put all the towns to the sword, including the animals and everything else they found. All the towns they came across there, they set on fire. Well, we're in a grim part of Judges. I want us to start by thinking about this. The rider serves the elephant. The rider serves the elephant. That is how psychologist Jonathan Haidt says that all humans make decisions. Let me make it simpler for us. We decide with our emotions first, that is the elephant in the picture, and then we use our reason to justify what we've already chosen. That's the rider. The rider serves the elephant. Or to put it simply, we feel first and we justify second. I mean, just look at Westminster this week. Abortion allowed up to birth. Assisted suicide. I mean, you can listen to the reasoning, can't you? It sounds so compassionate. We don't want people to suffer. We don't want mothers to be punished. But what actually happens? Well, the desire to end suffering creates more suffering. The attempt to show mercy becomes merciless. The pursuit of justice becomes injustice. That is what it looks like when everyone does what is right in their own eyes. But here's the terrifying part, and I mean absolutely terrifying. It's not just the politicians. It's not just them out there. It's us too. Christians. God's people do exactly the same thing. Now, we've been working our way through Judges. And last time we saw one man, we saw that Levite, doing what was right in his own sight. Do you remember how that ended? His concubine was abused, murdered, cut up into pieces. One man's compromise made God's people worse than the pagans around them. And boy, we wish the story ended there, don't we? But it carries on. We go from one man to now a whole nation. And this time, here's what makes this so dangerous. It's not obvious sin that's driving them. In fact, it's a righteous justice, righteous anger at genuine injustice. Here's the question that exposes all of us. What does justice look like when everyone does what's right in their own eyes? That is what Judges 20 is written to show us. It shows us that human justice without God becomes the very evil it seeks to destroy. And it happens in three devastating steps. We start with partial truth that creates flawed justice. Because when you only tell half the story, you can't make whole decisions. And then that flawed justice, well, it corrupts everything, especially our decisions. When anger drives us, even our prayer becomes demands. And finally, we see that unchecked justice becomes unlimited destruction. What starts tonight as righteous anger ends as ruthless revenge. And by the end of the chapter, we'll see why God says, "Vengeance is mine." So first, partial truth leads to flawed justice. Verses 1 to 17. Now, as we saw last time, a great injustice has happened in the town of Gibeah. God's people have become worse than Sodom and Gomorrah. So rightly, there needs to be justice. And it looks like we're going to get it. Have a look at verse 1. "Then all of Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, from the land of Gilead, came together and assembled before the Lord at Mizpah." Now, in Judges, that is unprecedented. Do you remember Deborah, all the way back in Judges 5? She was disappointed that Israel wouldn't come together. But now, the event in Gibeah has drawn everyone together. Well, not quite everyone. Notice verse 3. The Benjaminites are conspicuously absent. But the rest, they gather together and they say, "Tell us, how did this awful thing happen?" So up steps the Levite from last week. Just look how he's described. Verse 4, the Levite, the husband of the murdered woman. Hang on, who murdered her? I mean, that was ambiguous before, wasn't it? And that's going to help us see what's so wrong with Israel here. You see, verse 4, he says, "I and my concubine came to Gibeah in Benjamin to spend the night. During the night, the men of Gibeah came after me and surrounded the house intending to kill me. They raped my concubine and she died. I took my concubine, cut her into pieces, and sent one piece to each region of Israel's inheritance because they committed this lewd and outrageous act in Israel." Now, is that true? Well, yes, in part. Do you notice how he tells it? Just count the personal pronouns with me. I and my concubine. They came after me. They wanted to kill me. They raped my concubine. It's all about him, isn't it? And just notice how selective the account is. She died. She just happened to die. There's no mention of him seizing her and thrusting her outside the door to the mob outside to save his own skin, is there? As readers, we know what's happened, but Israel doesn't. But what happens next? Verse 8, it's mob justice. The people, they all gather together as one. They decide what they're going to do. Do you see that? They cast lots and they take 10 from every 100. Then end of verse 10, going to give them what they deserve for this outrageous act done in Israel. Do you see what the people have done? They've reacted. They've let the elephant steer the rider. They've made up their minds and they're going for it. Might not surprise us in Judges, but notice what they have not done. There's no mention of God. There's no investigation at all. There's no other witnesses called. But what they have righteous anger. And that feels to them like it's enough. That feels like now we can give justice. But what are they doing? They're doing what is right in their own sight. Here's why this gets so messy. Justice is deserved, isn't it? But not like this. The Levites' half-truth has led Israel to rush to judgment. And verse 11 tells us they're united as one. And it seems with pleasure, really, they're united as one to destroy their own people. It's really ironic in this book, isn't it? The very people who did not want to destroy the Canaanites at the start of the book cannot contain themselves when it comes to destroying their own brothers. Do we know that? We live in a world, don't we, where the thread goes viral, where the petition gets a million signatures in 24 hours. The cause that unites strangers around a shared outrage. I mean, it takes no effort to join a mob. It takes enormous effort to seek out the truth. And here's what should really terrify us. It is easier to unite people around human anger than around God's mission. It is easier to gather people around destruction than around discipleship. It is easier to march against enemies than to pray for them. Your verse 12. They send messengers to Benjamin demanding the guilty men be handed over. Right there, they're using language straight out of Deuteronomy chapter 13. That is language used about dealing with towns that have fallen into idolatry. But Benjamin there, do you notice, they won't listen. Maybe they're smelling the kangaroo courts. Maybe they're just loyal to their brothers. Maybe they're in rebellion. Either way, they refuse. And so it escalates. 26,000 Benjaminites plus 700 from Gibeah come out to fight, including, might remind you of Ehud, verse 16. Among all these soldiers were 700 select troops who were left-handed, each of them whom could sling a stone at a hare and not miss. The special elite troops of the day. And Israel, or verse 17, 400,000 swordsmen, all of them trained, all of them ready for battle. What an absolute mess, eh? What started as justice for one woman's death is now threatening to wipe out an entire tribe of Israel. 400,000 against 26,000. Brother against brother. You see, partial truth has now led to flawed justice. It's created civil war. But that flawed justice leads to corrupted decisions. Verses 18 to 35. You see, finally, the people head up to Bethel, the house of God, verse 18. They consult God. I mean, that's what they should have done from the beginning, isn't it? This looks possibly like a genuine seeking of God's will. But hang on a minute. Listen to what they ask. Verse 18. Who of us shall go up first to fight against the Benjaminites? Does that sound familiar? Well, it should. It's almost identical to the very beginning of Judges. After the death of Joshua, the Israelites asked the Lord, who of us is to go up first to fight against the Canaanites? Do you notice the grim difference? Back then it was Canaanites, now it's their brother Benjamin. And here's the key to understand what's going on here. They're not asking, should we fight Benjamin? They're asking, who should go do what we've decided already? They've already decided to fight. They just want God's technique. They don't want God's direction. They want God to rubber stamp this, their own plan. They're not seeking God's will. They're demanding God's approval. But just like the conquest, Judah gets chosen to lead. But it goes terribly wrong. Do you see? They pitch camp, they attack. 22,000 Israelites die that day. So take two, they try again, verse 23. This time they go up weeping before the Lord and they ask, I mean, there's some progress there. Shall we go up again to fight against the Benjaminites, our fellow Israelites? Just notice now they're calling them fellow Israelites. I mean, that's better, isn't it? And now God says, go up against them. So what do you expect to happen next? Victory? Verse 25. This time when the Benjaminites came out from Gibeah to oppose them, they cut down another 18,000 Israelites, all of them armed with swords. No Benjaminite casualties, do you notice? It's a crushing defeat. 18,000 more dead men. Whoa, wait a minute. Didn't God say go up and fight against them? I mean, if God approved it, why are his people still dying? If this is justice, why does this feel like judgment? Well, attempt number three, verse 26. They weep, they fast, they offer sacrifices. They ask again, shall we go up again to fight against the Benjaminites, our fellow Israelites, or not? And now, the Lord says, go, for tomorrow I will give them into your hands. And this time it works. The Benjaminites are confident. They're 2-0 up, right? Same again. But Israel has a new strategy. They outflank Benjamin. Disaster comes. Verse 35. On that day, the Israelites struck down 25,100 Benjaminites, all armed with swords. Then the Benjaminites saw that they were beaten. I mean, what is going on there? Three attempts, two crushing defeats for Israel, one devastating victory. It's confusing, isn't it? But we can make sense of it. Have a look at the first half of verse 35 one more time. The Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel. That there tells us everything. Who is the king of Israel? God. God has been in charge from the very beginning. God has been doing exactly what God intends to do. Here's what's happening. God has moved from being their ally to being their judge. He's giving them what they demanded while showing them what it costs. Israel is fighting these battles exactly as they should have fought, as they did fight against the Canaanites. But now the true king is showing them something. When you pursue your own justice instead of mine, even I can give you what you want, and it will destroy you. Here's why this passage disturbs us so much, I reckon. We always assume that God's allowance equals God's approval. We think the success means we're right. This chapter shatters that assumption, doesn't it? Of course it's right. God can work through our flawed plans whilst simultaneously judging our methods. He can give us exactly what we demand while showing us exactly what it costs. Just because God allows something doesn't mean God approves of something. That's corrupted decision making. And just look where it ends up. It leads to deadly consequences. Because the destruction doesn't stop there. Final point this evening. Corrupted decisions become unlimited destruction. Verses 36 to 48. See, the men, they charge into Gibeah. They put the whole city to the sword. And here's what's chilling. The description there matches exactly what God commanded them to do to the Canaanites. Except again, now it's Israel on Israel. That's the Benjamin. They try and flee into the wilderness, but they can't escape. Others in Israel hunt them down too. The body count, verse 44, 18,000 Benjaminites fell, all of them valiant fighters. But it doesn't stop there, does it? More flee towards the Rock of Rimmon, and another 2,000 are killed. And the summary is devastating. Verse 46, on that day, 25,000 Benjaminite swordsmen fell, all of them valiant fighters. Only 600 of them are left, hiding in the rocks. I mean, that's not justice, is it? That's genocide. But it doesn't stop there. Watch what happens next. This is where unlimited destruction reveals itself. Verse 48. The men of Israel went back to Benjamin and put all the towns to the sword, including the animals and everything else they found. All the towns they came across, they set on fire. Wait, what? We've dealt with the injustice of Gibeah, tick. We won the battle, tick. We got justice, tick. Why are we still destroying? That's what unlimited destruction looks like. It just cannot stop. It doesn't know when enough is enough. What started as righteous anger at real injustice has become ruthless revenge against an entire people. They are treating their own family worse than they ever treated their enemies. They are more committed to destroying each other than they were to ever conquering the Canaanites. That is the result of doing what is right in your own sight. That is what happens when you follow the flow, when you follow the mob, when you trust your righteous anger more than God's righteous justice. And we'll see next time in chapter 21, even this isn't the end of the story. The destruction is going to keep on spreading. See, these chapters here, they're meant to shock us. They're meant to shock us into seeing where this pattern might be happening in our own lives. Because there, but for the grace of God, go I. So we've seen the progression tonight, haven't we? From partial truth to corrupted decisions to unlimited destruction. From one man's compromise, chapter 19, to a whole nation's civil war in chapter 20. That is what happens when humanity is left to its own devices. They did it before at the time of the flood. Same problem. They do it all the way through the book of Judges. We still do it today. We always veer towards death. At the beginning of life, at the end of life, and everywhere in between. But here's what we can't escape. Yes, there is a need for justice in this world. Yes, there are wrongs that need to be made right. It's only Christianity that can say that. The injustice in Gibeah was real. The anger was righteous. But Judges chapter 20 shows us that even our best attempts at justice are evil without God. Even when we're right about the problem, we become part of the problem when we pursue justice our way instead of God's way. So where does this leave us? It leaves us desperate, desperate for God's justice. See, only God's justice can truly put things right. Only God as the king allows for perfect justice. That is why God says this: it is mine to avenge. I will repay. That is great news. It's not a threat, it's a promise. It's not something to fear, it is our only hope. Because we have a far better story to tell, don't we? Perfect justice has been poured out at the cross for everyone who trusts in the Lord Jesus. The wrath that our injustice deserved was absorbed by the one who never did any wrong. And perfect justice will be poured out on the last day for those not covered by the blood of the Lamb. We don't need to do what is right in our own sight. We can trust the one who is always right. The mob will always be there. The outrage will always be trending. The cause will always be recruiting. But God's people, we're called to something different. We're called to seek truth before justice. We're called to pray before we march. We're called to trust God's timing instead of demanding our own. Because human justice without God becomes the very evil it seeks to destroy. But God's justice through Christ becomes the hope that transforms everything. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Any questions can be sent to podcast@david-couch.com. I'll see you again next time.